You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
At this level, at the college level, there are no single, simple formulas that will tell you the best way to proceed. You must become the kind of person, the kind of writer, who makes the right judgment calls when the moment calls for judgment. I've repeated that bit so many times to so many groups of freshman writing students that I've lost count. But what if we took the same Wittgensteinian wisdom to the front of the room and confronted professors with the need to become masters of a craft? Peter Lindsay has done just that with his recent book, The Craft of University Teaching, and Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome him aboard. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Lindsay.
Well, thanks for having me.
I don't often ask authors about their prefaces, but yours arrested my attention, and I think it sets up our conversation nicely. So, what makes so many professors reticent to identify ourselves as teachers when that's what we spend so much of our time doing?
Well, I think the big reason is that, you know, when people go to grad school, they have a self-image of themselves as being great researchers more than anything else. And it's hard not to spend, you know, 4 to 6 years spending the great works of your discipline without dreaming of writing something that future grad students are going to have to read. So I think that's the ideal that people have in their head. And, you know, in my case, I went to grad school after being a high school teacher because I wanted to do something besides teach. I really wanted to research. So I think that, and of course the academy rewards researching in all sorts of ways, practical ways, but also in terms of one's image and one's prestige level, in ways that it doesn't reward teaching necessarily. And so I think that the incentive structures and just overall people's ideas about why they want to be academics and ideas about academia lead to teaching playing second fiddle. But there's also the fact that, you know, if you're engaged in these high ideals or high-minded ideas, as we are when we're writing a dissertation or doing research, to some people, teaching seems like a come down from that because you go back to teaching at an introductory level. I think that's wrong-headed because I think that a lot of the teaching we do is very clarifying to the research we do, which is something I think I talked about in the preface. And if you can't, communicate something to undergraduates and graduate students, you certainly can't communicate it to the world outside. You can't communicate it to other scholars. It really needs to be clear to undergraduates if it's going to go anywhere as research. So I think it's a mistake, but I do understand that if you're involved in, high levels of particle physics, then going back and teaching physics 101 is going to seem like a come down. But I think that's a mistaken idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting is this book, if I'm reading it right, even calls for some caution when it comes to educational theory, that field of learning, because you call for ample room for practical reason. Now, that, sounds to me like an Aristotelian distinction. So in what ways is this book, The Craft of University Teaching, an Aristotelian book, and in what ways does it take a different path from Aristotle's?
Well, it's funny, listeners should note that you were kind enough to give me some questions ahead of time. So I had a look at that very question, and I was stumped at first. I hadn't thought about the book because Aristotelian, and I was going to punt again. But in your introduction, you actually said something that made me see what you were thinking about there. I mean, when I think of Aristotelian as a political philosopher, I think of virtue ethics. But what you, I think, are talking about, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this notion that that I have in the book that you have to try to be the person, the type of teacher for whom strategies in the classroom and just ways of teaching come naturally. So it's not a question of learning techniques. It's a question of learning to be the type of person for whom certain techniques make more sense and come more easily. Is that right? Is that what you meant by Aristotelian.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that approach to things, I mean, strikes me as akin, at the very least, to Aristotle's notion of, and I didn't look at the Greek before this, so I think it's Phronesis in Book 6 of the Nicomachean Ethics, the notion of practical reason.
Well, right. I mean, without getting too technical about Aristotle there, the example that I gave in the book of Aristotle explicitly was this notion of habituation.
Yeah.
So most of Aristotle's ethical training, you know, Aristotle states that ethics is a practical virtue, not a theoretical one. It can't be learned in books. It needs to be practiced. The example I always give students is that, you know, back in the 1970s or 60s, people used to litter at will, and then ordinances went up and said, don't litter. And it was an external or an extrinsic motivation not to litter. You could get arrested for doing it. That gradually over time, people became habituated to, and it became something that they internalized. Mm-hmm. And that's what Aristotle has in mind about, you know, repeatedly doing the right things is what leads to having a, if you will, a perspective or a state of mind that leads to ethical thinking or an ethical life. It's a good observation that might really encapsulate what the whole pedagogical theory I have is, and that is that if we train ourselves to adopt certain behaviors that have proven successful in the classroom, we can sort of inhabit that teaching persona and become that person. And that makes a lot of teaching a lot easier, because then you simply ask, well, what would that person do? Which I understand is maybe taking something from Christian idea about what would Jesus do, but it's not, you know, it's the same idea. It's you're actually trying to get inside the mindset of somebody whose views you respect and whose views you want to emulate. And in this case, though, it's not a moral teacher like Jesus. It's a pedagogical model that you have in your mind. And so internalizing that can be very helpful. I apologize for that phone message there. But does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, since we're already talking about it, one of the concepts that I found most powerful in this book is the notion in chapter 2 of that teaching persona you've been talking about. I said, I mean, you know, it strikes an Aristotelian chord for me, because it's not a matter of learning the right technique, but it's a matter of learning, you know, a variety of possible maneuvers, and then, you know, becoming the kind of person who knows what kind of maneuver to take, right? So, I mean, you know, this notion of the teaching persona might fly in the face of, you know, certain approaches that would call for authenticity as the chief virtue, right? What would you have to say?
Go ahead.
Rock and roll.
No, I think that's a very good point, and it points to a tension in my own argument. And I address that in the chapter. How far from can the persona be from the person?
Mm-hmm.
To what extent can you get by with an act? And, you know, at one extreme, I do say, look, if you're burned out and you're not going anywhere and you don't want to quit, then fake it. But that's the extreme. And I only defend that because the alternative of just going through the motions is worse. And I also think that faking it for a while might lead to actually becoming the person you're faking being. But having said that, I don't think there's necessarily a great distance between the person and the persona they adopt. The persona will always be mediated by someone's personality. And I'm not suggesting that people, you know, I think it was in that chapter that I talked about ice breaking exercises, and I talked about certain ice breaking exercises that I could never do just because they strike me as completely inane and sort of childish, but that other people could pull off, and those other people are not inane and childish, but it's just not for me. So there are always going to be limits to what your persona can do. And those limits are limits that are circumscribed by your personality. But having said that, I do think that within those limits, we can really step outside and try to be a different way than we are. And we do that unconsciously anyway. My wife will tell me when she observes me in the classroom that everything about my body language and my tone is completely different than it is just in normal everyday conversation. So we do that. And then the issue, if that's the case, then can we tap into that fact and sort of train ourselves? A rather banal example I gave was putting on a tie. When I started teaching, I was pretty young, and I was teaching in a high school where they had a dress code. And I was grateful for that because the tie sort of put me in a mindset above the 26 years of age that I was. And made me sort of feel older, and I inhabited that slightly more mature personality just from looking down at what I was wearing. Mm-hmm. So that's a sort of simple example, but I think that there are a lot of sort of more profound ways in which we can learn to be a different way in the classroom. And that, yeah, to get to the point that you repeated of mine, that when we do that, and then when we ask, well, what would this my persona do? Techniques really sort of suggest themselves to us, and we start to see, oh, this would work well. This would, and I think that is a more natural way to approach the good pedagogical techniques that are out there, mm-hmm. than simply. Reading a book and a list of techniques, many of which wouldn't be appropriate for the context in which you're teaching or for your personality. But that certain techniques present themselves to a personality will mean that there is a sort of synergy between the personality and the technique. And I think that the techniques will be a lot more effective for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, this notion of personality and persona that we're working with here. I mean, you know, it strikes me as a fairly sophisticated psychology as well, because it treats personality not as a single template, but as a sort of dynamic but finite range of possibilities, right? So that, you know, when you adopt this teacher persona, it is still your personality. It is just this part of it rather than that part.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's I mean, again, I want to think that people can stretch the who they are and become and try different things if they're really not having any luck in the classroom, that try certain things that wouldn't come naturally to them, and to the extent that they pull it off, it means that their personality is compatible with it to some extent. Mm-hmm. You know, I would never tell somebody, you know, go out and be funny or go out and be empathetic. If you're not those things, you're not going to be those things. But there are ways in which you can train yourself, I think, to be certain ways and to have a certain personality type. But the degree of success you'll have is very closely tied to, you know, just how far a stretch it is for your personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn from the persona to the practice of teaching. And one thing that is noticeable right out of the gate is that for this book, teaching is a means to learning, to be sure, but it still deserves attention as a practice in its own right. So what intellectual pressures and what institutional errors are you resisting by insisting that teaching itself is a practice?
Well, there's a, you know, community of faculty developers and a community of people that study educational theory. And in that, you'll hear a constant refrain. It's not about teaching, it's about learning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for instance, when I was a teaching center director myself, and people would come in and they'd say, you know, I teach and I teach and I teach and they just won't learn. And of course, the obvious response is, well, if they're not learning, are you really teaching? I mean, isn't the definition of teaching, you know, the creation of learning? And so there's a lot to this notion that it's not about teaching, it's about learning. But and I don't mean to dismiss that idea or to suggest it's not accurate. You can't teach anything unless somebody's learning. You haven't taught anything if no one's learning. Mm-hmm. But the emphasis mm-hmm. is so so far toward the sort of learning model. And this came out in theories, in educational theory, about that, this learning model, that we've forgotten that, you know, we're teachers. And while we want to see students learn, we also want, there's a performative aspect to it. There's a, you know, there is a craft aspect of it. We should actually enjoy this activity and not just, and think about, yes, how we can get students to learn, but how we can actually enjoy what we're doing and how we can be fulfilled in what we're doing and how we can treat it as this sort of craft activity that will have the effect, if we do it well, of students learning, but that deserves to be focused on as an activity in its own right. So it was really more a statement made to the you know, educational community that likes to complete to always talk about, it's about learning, it's about learning. And my response is, yes, it's about learning, but let's not forget that we're employed as teachers, we're doing this, and we can't forget that if students were learning but we weren't enjoying what we were doing, that wouldn't be any good either. So we ideally want students to learn, and this gets to Aristotle too. We want to enjoy doing the things that make us good at what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn to one of your controversial points that I enjoyed greatly. You seem to be, as I said, courting controversy when you claim that motivation is not one factor that constitutes successful teaching, but motivation is successful teaching. I want to step back and let you make the case for this, because even if they end up disagreeing, I think our listeners will find this claim interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, the model that I'm fighting against is the model that we simply transfer knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that's what teaching is about. I think if we transfer knowledge, in most cases, we transfer it for as long as it takes for the students to transfer it back to us in a test. And if there's no excitement about what we've transferred, they're going to regurgitate it back, and that's going to be it. And on a, you know, an idea of what learning is, both a physiological idea or a neurological idea of what learning is, but just our common sense understanding of what learning is, that doesn't strike me as very good learning. And so it matters the way in which we hold the learning, the way in which we, the excitedness with which we take on whatever we're taking on, that's going to actually have a massive impact or effect upon how the depth of our learning. And so and let's face it, I mean, if it's just about transfer of knowledge, you can read it in a book. I'm not sure why you need a classroom. I'm not sure why you need a professor. You can read it in a book. Their books transfer it to you as well. Get an audio book if you don't like to read. What classrooms add, besides the intersubjective level of you know, having a social environment in which learning is so much more powerful, is they add, I think, a reason to be motivated about what you're learning. And this really gets to the defense that I would have that learning is, or teaching is about not the transfer of knowledge, but the transfer of enthusiasm for knowledge. At the end of the day, students are their own best teachers. Students will teach themselves. And if they don't teach themselves, they're not going to learn. They're not going to necessarily learn it from anybody else until they, unless they're capable of teaching it to themselves at some level. And they have to be motivated to do that. And that's where we come in. So we don't come in to pour the knowledge into them, to use, you know, that's what was Paulo Freire referred to as the banking model of education, where we just pour the knowledge into them.
Yeah, I wonder if Freire was
going to come into this. Yeah, right. Well, I was very influenced by him when I read him in graduate school many years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Freire's notion is you can pour the knowledge into them, but the knowledge is not going to be very meaningful unless you provide a context in which it has meaning in their life and motivates them to dig deeper. And so, so again, my goal is to, when they come into a class, have them leave the class, learn, thinking to themselves, that was really interesting. I didn't get it all, but now I'm going to go work on it myself. And the working out of it themselves is going to be where the learning comes in. So if I explain, you know, the quadratic equation to somebody, they may get it and it may not be the most scintillating thing, so they may want to forget it. And but even if they do, they're not going to remember it very long. Whereas if they, if I can motivate them to go home and figure it out, you know, that process, that hour or 2 hours or 12 hours they take doing it is really going to imprint upon them in a more fundamental level. So everything rests on the motivation to do that. At the end of the day, I should add to those, to the listeners who haven't read the book, I am just convinced that the attitude that if we take an attitude that it's about the transfer of enthusiasm for knowledge, we'll end up doing almost very many of the same sorts of things, and will require of students that they, you know, they have, they acquire the mastery of the material that we require of them. It's not that, you know, at the end of the day we ask them if they're enthusiastic, and if they say yes, we give them an A and that's it. They still have to pass the test. Mm-hmm. But they, if they pass the test, mm-hmm. we want them to pass the test because they were motivated to learn and they did it. So one practical, and I talk in the book about a couple of practical sort of ramifications of thinking of teaching as the transfer of enthusiasm for knowledge. You know, if you have 10 sections in the chapter and you've got it in your head that you've got to quote unquote cover the chapter on a Thursday, you can go in and you can divide your 75 minutes into 7.5 minutes per section and just methodically go through it all. And by the time you get to section 3, half your students will be asleep, and by the time you get to section 8, some will be suicidal, and by the time you get to the end, they'll all be asleep. And so you will have covered a few sections. My strategy would be, no, don't cover it. The students need to know it, but that doesn't mean you need to cover it. You need to get them to cover it and to teach it to themselves. Either teach it to your own self or to help each other outside of the classroom to teach it. And so my idea was, no, take two or three sections that you think you can really hit out of the park and come up with great examples if that's relevant to your field, or just find the two or three sections that you think you can generate the most enthusiasm about. And the rest will take its course. You know, the other seven sections that you didn't cover, that's on the students. But, you know, if it's not ever on the students, then it's not ever going to be learned. So, again, just the last thing, just to reiterate, I do say that teaching is not transferring knowledge, but transferring enthusiasm. But only because really the most effective way to transfer knowledge is to transfer enthusiasm, because you're, at the end of the day, not really transferring as so much as you're getting students to give it to themselves. And that's the most effective way to learn, in my mind.
Right. Well, I want to ask about another of those particular strategies to, you know, inspire motivation. And it's the one where you talk about explaining class material and why it's worth learning. So I'm an English professor, so I feel like I read half a dozen articles every month calling for English professors to make a case for the humanities in the face of declining English and history majors, or, you know, calling on philosophers to, you know, explain the worthiness of philosophy. Is this the same kind of thing you're talking about, or do you have something else in mind?
Well, it, you know, a lot of that is, you know, as somebody teaches political philosophy, yeah, my philosophy chairs are always sending out emails from articles or news articles that show that a philosophy degree will get you a long way in business and things like this. And it's important for students in philosophy and in modern language in history and the humanities to know these things, that there is practical value to it. I wouldn't want it to just be that instrumental. So I would want to say also that, you know, in your case, your students reading Chaucer, or in my case, you know, reading Aristotle, is not just good because it's going to train you in a way and make you literate in a way that might help you in a job interview or might help your logic skills in a business community. It's good in a way because it adds a certain depth to your life that you'll have no matter what career you go into. And that sounds pretty idealistic. I don't know how to avoid that, and I'm sure you would agree with me as an English professor. I don't know how to avoid that being an important part of what we think, you know, education should be about. So I'm not – I am – you know, it's a battle again. You know, why read history? Why read literature? Why read philosophy? I want at one level to, yes, convince them that this might come in handy. But at the other level, you know, I teach a intro to philosophy, intro to history of political thought class, where I begin the first day by saying, I'm going to teach you nothing of any use. Nothing that I teach you will be useful at all to you. And then I discuss what the meaning of usefulness might be, and I twist it a little bit. But at the end of the day, I really do want to get the message across that the learning in these courses is an end in its own right. It doesn't need to be seen as instrumental to some further end, and that life can be enriched. Then it's on us. You know, it's on you as a literature professor to show, like, why is knowing Shakespeare going to make your life better? And there are all sorts of strategies for that. But the most important is to show the relevance to students' own lives. You can't teach an abstract concept unless you can frame it, hang it on some context that's meaningful to the students' lives. And because if it doesn't have any, they don't have any frame of reference to accept the concept, they won't be able to learn it. So if you can show why the knowledge that we're giving in the humanities is relevant to their lives, not just their work lives, but their overall life, like how it might help them understand their relationships with other people, for instance, how it might make them appreciate the beauty and abhor the brutality around them, make them good citizens, then I think you've done a lot to persuading them that literature and history and philosophy are important endeavors.
Mm-hmm. I want to stick with this for a moment because I saw some Augustine and I saw some Dante in this book. Your emphasis on motivation reminds me, and I'm a Christian college professor, of Augustine's City of God and Dante's Commedia in their strong visions of desire and love as the primary realities that make a person this sort of person rather than that sort of person. And of course, unfortunately, Augustine completely forgets about that when he actually writes about education, but we can dismiss that for a moment. Would you say that your own pedagogy and your own writing has a religious element to it? Or are you after something else with your focus on motivation and desire?
Let me preface or before I answer that question, I'm interested that your reference to Augustine and Dante. I was an undergraduate major in Italian literature, so
oh, wonderful.
And having said that, and you know, having read the Divine Comedy in the original many years ago, it's interesting to me that you saw some Dante in there because I didn't see it, but it's probably somewhere in the back of my mind. And I'll also say that I spent some time in graduate school looking at the City of God and showing the extent to which he had taken a lot of the ideas from Cicero. Mm-hmm. And the addition of it that I used actually had, I think, his filling in the fragments of it. And if I'm not mistaken, actually Cicero's De Republica was taken from a parchment that of the City of God
that was
peeled
okay.
back and found underneath it. Yeah. Anyway, is there religion in it? My short answer is I guess it depends on what how we're defining religion. I mean, I certainly would hope the book is more ecumenical than to say it's Christian or Jewish or Muslim. But maybe if you could give me a working definition of religion, I can respond better to that question.
Oh, that's always the trick, isn't it? I hate to be a philosopher here, but... No, that's all right. That's all right. You know, I guess the impulse to look at, you know, that those core desires of humanity as opposed to, you know, the instrumentalism of education that so often reigns in our own moment struck me, you know, even if not as a sectarian move, as something that I would characterize as, you know, if you don't want to call it religious, then certainly existential in character.
Yeah. Let me say this, and then you can chime in and help me out if I'm not mm-hmm. going the right direction or I'm not going the direction that addresses your question.
I'm not sure there is a right direction.
Well, I'll do my best. We'll send it off in some direction. But, you know, the instrumentalization of education is something that I do discuss early on, maybe in the preface. You know, the notion that, you know, what I just mentioned, that education is seen as a means to something else. So a common response that students in majoring in philosophy get when they go home and, you know, at Christmas and tell their aunt that they're studying philosophy and I say, and what does your aunt say? And they'll always know the answer, which is, what are you going to do with that? And, you know, that suggests that education is for something. It's not for its own intrinsic worth. And that is something that the craft perspective fights against because, mm-hmm. you know, craft production mm-hmm. is something where the process and the product are meaningful to the person making it, not just for the paycheck that ensues. And so that sort of devotion to a cause or to a calling, you know, maybe we should go to Luther here or to, you know, the Protestant Reformation here or to Calvin rather, in the notion of a calling, I think gets close to what mm-hmm. I'm looking at in terms of a craft, you know, something that is not just a career, but something that goes to the, you know, as you say, this sort of existential idea that it goes to the heart of who you are and it expresses who you are. If teaching is not that, if it doesn't go to the heart of who you are, I don't think you're going to be as effective. And that's the same with any job. I mean, I think one of the reasons that, you know, factory work, as Adam Smith pointed out, is so stultifying is that it doesn't go to the heart of who you are. It's just something that you get a paycheck for. Now, the idea, I want to be ecumenical about this and ecumenical beyond just religions. You know, Marx talked about this to give an example of the anathema of religion. You know, Marx talked about he didn't call it an existential crisis, but the fact that production for a paycheck was really how he defined alienation, that we are not what we the embodiment of what we're doing anymore. It's no longer a calling. Again, Marx wouldn't have used that word. But so I think that the idea of working as a means of self-actualization, as a means of realizing one's calling, you know, there are a lot of ways to describe it, goes to the heart of what the craft production is about. And to the extent that this is deeply embedded in a lot of religious traditions, I'll gladly accept their support on the idea.
Very good, very good. I want to turn to the last segment of the book that you know, I enjoyed so much, largely because it gives me a reference, justification, if you will, to keep doing things that I've been doing for years but now I can point my department chair to a book that says I should do it. And one of those is that I very seldom, and in fact it might be, no, I do on occasion, but I very seldom assign textbooks. And, you know, some of my colleagues find that odd that I always either assign primary texts or, you know, yeah, I mean, that's almost always what I do. I'll just go ahead and say that. But you do make a case for textbooks and what they are good for. So tell our listeners, what are textbooks good for, and why do primary texts and case studies make for better craft teaching than textbooks do?
Well, just to modify slightly what you just said, I don't necessarily make a case for textbooks. In fact, I am fairly critical of most of them. All I say is that there are probably some good ones out there, but I, like you, don't use them. I think, you know, there are a lot of references that aren't teaching anything. The best example I give in the book, or I can give you, is one I give in the book, and that is of a dictionary. Mm-hmm. A dictionary can tell you the definition of a word. It can't teach it to you because it's certainly not going to excite you. And so in the chapter on reading, I mentioned, you know, definitions of a fractal. And if you and I think I quoted from Webster's and a few other sources, and they're not only completely not understandable. There's a dog in the background, but he's mad about the fractals, I suppose. Not only are they not understandable, they're not something that would motivate you. My concern about textbooks is they have the transfer of knowledge in mind, but not the excitement in mind. Now, that was the case with a lot of textbooks that I used as an undergraduate, and it's the case of a lot of textbooks I still see. I think that there are great textbooks out there. I have a colleague, Mike Evans, who's written a wonderful textbook on American government, and I think that there are a lot of things that are great about it, and they're great because he's intent on motivating students to learn something about American government. So my concern about anything we have students read is that they have, again, when I talk about teaching as motivating, it's not that we have to motivate just in terms of our personality. We have to create a learning environment, and a lot of that involves things that we do with no students around, like create a syllabus, choose the readings, choose the assignments, choose the methods of assessment. All these things are ways in which we can hopefully motivate our students. And so what we want to do is, when it comes to a textbook or any sort of reading, ask ourselves, you know, is this going to be something that motivates? Now, the comeback to you and to me, I don't know if you teach, very old literature, but, you know, even just teaching something like Shakespeare, to go back to Chaucer, or in my undergraduate experience, you know, Boccaccio and Dante, and in teaching philosophy, there's a lot to be said for how little motivational value there is. I mean, you talked about the Nicomachean Ethics. That's a pretty dry text. But nonetheless, if we're going to teach the history of philosophy, or you're going to teach the history of English literature, you're going to have to assign that. And so there's going to be a motivational problem there too, and we just need to consider that. So I don't mean to dump on textbooks per se. I want to just be critical of any reading material in the same way I'm critical of any teacher who in that if the reading material is just transferring and not motivating in some way, it's going to run into a problem.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I want to talk a little bit about your long chapter on technology. You approach this in a Socratic stance, saying that you're trying to irritate the reader. Mission accomplished. I won't spoil this irritant so that our listeners can enjoy it when they buy your book. But I do want to talk about the very Greek structure of your main argument about technology, namely that the end of education should always govern the intermediate deliberation we undertake, And that deliberation should always be in motion before we take on any technology, new or old. Once again, I mean, you know, this is straight out of the Nicomachean Ethics. It seems like good old Aristotelian medicine to me. What makes this reasoning process so important for students and teachers, and what happens when we don't undertake this line of thought?
Well, yeah, I won't give it away either. I want people to buy the book, but but you know, not that I'm making a lot of money off of it, but no, I want people to buy the book because I like the message. But and by the way, if people buy it and have any thoughts on it, feel free to contact me, and I'd love to hear people's thoughts about it. The idea in the technology chapter, it really grew out of being a teaching center director and seeing a lot of mindless administration aimed at improving teaching by improving technology. Mm-hmm. So you have a what's supposed to be an educational initiative where you hand attention-addled students a laptop or an iPad and tell them to go into a classroom and this will help your learning. I'm not sure how it's like handing a meth addict, you know, some meth on the way into the classroom. You know, a lot of administrators are administrators because they're sick of the classroom and they think that this is a good idea in terms of an educational policy. And even in the faculty development world, there's a lot of emphasis put on, you know, what technologies are good in the classroom. Now, you can't teach without technology. You know, chalk is a technology, paper, chalkboard. These are all technologies.
Class sets of identical textbooks.
Yeah, right. So my message is not that technology is the enemy. My message was that the perspective with which we approached it was the enemy. And the sort of administrative approach had it backwards. It was, you know, I'm going to throw $100,000 at a group of iPads and hand them to the professors. You go figure out a way that those will be effective in a classroom. That's to say that the technology is driving the pedagogy, and that the end is the technology and the means is the pedagogy. And I just think that's got it wrong. The technology is a means to education, not an end in itself. And so we shouldn't be saying, as again, many administrators do, find out how you can use a technology in the classroom. We should be saying, find out how you can get students to learn in the classroom. And if any technologies are helpful, then use them. That's fine. So the overall approach that I had, or that I laid out in that chapter, was, you know, read the material or find out, you know, you've got this body of material that students need to know. So your first task is to isolate the points that you want to talk about with them. And it's not all the points. You don't cover everything, as the adage is, coverage is the enemy of learning. Because if you try to cover too much, you dampen the enthusiasm. But find out which concepts you want to teach, and then ask yourself how best to do it, and ask yourself what's the context, what kind of examples might you use, and you think all of that through. And then once you've done that, then you ask yourself, would any technology help? And I'm not just talking about higher tech, you know, would just going to the whiteboard and picking up the marker and drawing something visually. Do you need visualization? Mm-hmm. But note that before you've decided on the whiteboard, you've asked yourself, do you need visualization? That's the prior pedagogical question. I know colleagues that can't write or can't prepare for class without uploading or opening a PowerPoint program. Well, that's to say you've already decided that PowerPoint is the way to go. PowerPoint is almost never, by the way, the way to go. And I could talk about my experiences observing classes over 4 years and the rather unscientific study I did about the effectiveness of PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. As my colleague and mentor Harry Dangle once said, it's the karaoke of education.
I'm gonna remember that.
Well, I want to give Harry credit for it. But he's exactly right, right? But anyway, without going into PowerPoint right away, when you start preparing for class by opening up PowerPoint, you've decided that that's the means. And again, so you've chosen the technology and your way of teaching has to fit that technology, which again has it backwards. You can't choose the technology and make the pedagogy fit into it. You've got to choose the pedagogical strategies and then employ the technologies that might fit that and might not. So again, there are a lot of good technologies out there, even high technologies out there, things like clickers, you know, which are classroom response systems I've seen used very effectively. And, you know, I've seen laptops used effectively. I've seen iPads used effectively. I've seen, classroom discussion boards, virtual discussion boards used very effectively. But they're only used effectively if someone's given prior thought to what they want to teach and how they want students to come to that understanding in a way that they're enthusiastic about it, and then thought to themselves, hey, that might be a good way to do it. Mm-hmm. Or better yet, hey, that might be a bad way to do it. There's just a default position. To give you another example, ask listeners who are college professors how many of your administrators pride themselves on how many classrooms are fully wired and fully, you know, Wi-Fi'd and have all the means which you can tap into the web and to social media. That's just taken as a good thing. One education policy I would love to see, and you know, certain places I hope have it, are classrooms where there's a lead shield around them in the walls so that there's no possibility of any students getting on the internet. We all of us know what the bane of our existence, cell phones, are. What about an educational policy that starts by saying, hey, well, let's have some spaces where only the physical interactions we have with our fellow classmates and our teachers are going to be the only human interactions we have for the next 75 minutes or 45 minutes or however long class is. You don't see that type of thinking where people think first about technology and second about education. So I'm glad I got your interest, and I should ask you whether in getting irritated about the way I started the chapter, which to tell the readers a little bit was just a major rant about the evils of technology. Did I irritate you to the point where you turned off, or did I irritate you to the point where you got kind of more enthusiastic about hearing what I had to say after it?
Oh, I was enthusiastic to hear what you had to say, and my approach, and I think it's largely because I do teach so many Greeks, has been to think of the end first. So the tech that I do use in class, my students often make fun of me that my taste in pop music and my technological awareness end in about 1997. if I'm in a writing class, one of the things that I like to do is to have students generate text so that I can see it immediately, give them feedback immediately, and have them rewrite it, you know, four or five times over the course of a class period. And for that, right. The latest, cell phone app isn't going to do much good, but a good old-fashioned 1997 chat room does, because I can have them, put a paragraph that they've just generated in class up on the board, and I can say, all right, as you rewrite this, try to do this, this, and this. I can see their rewrites. I can make commentary on that. and we can get through several cycles in an hour rather than over the course of a week.
Right, right. And know what you've done, that, you know, you've thought about, you know, how you want students to experience their learning, and then you've thought about a means to do it. And that's exactly the order of things that that I think is an important thing. So I'm glad to know I succeeded when I when you mentioned that I did get your goat. You know, the bottom line is I don't really like to irritate anybody, but I'll do it in the name of if I think that it might serve a pedagogical purpose.
Good. I got a quick follow-up question. I mean, I learned this way to think about education from Neil Postman, who I started reading about 20 years ago. Has he been an influence on your project, or is that a coincidence?
Well, I, like you, read Neil Postman 20 years ago. Technopoly, was that the book? I can't remember.
Yeah, that was one of them, and The End of Education and Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Yeah.
They all remind me of your project here.
Yeah, it was really Jacques Ellul's book, Technological Society. That motivated my thinking. And I think I have a quote at the beginning, and I talk about Ellul a little bit. And it's really this notion, and it goes into also German critical theory, that there's this sort of rationalization of technique and technology that is subverting our ability to, you know, think in ways of what we might call substantive rationality. So we know how to do things. Technology, you know, my students can give me the answer to any objective question in 30 seconds where they're by asking Siri on their cell phone. But I think that this sort of slavery to means ends rationality that technology promotes is at the expense, and maybe this is where you're talking about religion, is at the expense of thinking about ethical matters. It teaches us what is, but blinds us to the importance of what ought to be and how we ought to live a good life, which was Aristotle's question, to point to obviously someone who wasn't Christian. But of course, it is the question that animates all religions too. And I think that technology and the extent to which we're subservient to us has blinded us to larger ethical concerns that really should be of importance. And so technology has become the end, not just with regard to education, but with regard to life itself. And so I want to remind people, as Ellul did, and as critical theorists do, I think, and I'm speaking here with people like Habermas, but also going back to Max Weber, I want to remind people that this rationalization of the world comes at a price, and that we need to be thinking about deeper matters of why techniques are important, why the knowledge of facts is important, to what use do we put them. You know, you can know an awful lot without knowing how to live it, and that's a problem.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, I want to go back to Wittgenstein. I mentioned him in my opening statement, and your book's closing chapter struck me, as Wittgensteinian in a way. Teaching obviously involves expectations and rules, but if we try to systematize them too easily and too neatly, the real complexity of the practice eludes us, and it might just be that the best thing that we can do as thinkers about education is to describe the really good pedagogical practices really carefully. So once again, am I just finding my favorite thinkers in your book, or is Wittgenstein in there?
Well, in that case, I have to say that, it may be that you're finding it, but it may be that you're finding it because it's there, but I didn't intentionally put it there. And I have to say that because I'm not a Wittgenstein scholar by any shape of the imagination. So, but I'm glad you saw it there. It's like a Rorschach test. and I'm sure other professors will find other thinkers there. I mean, if what I take from what you said to be Wittgensteinian, then I guess I would agree that And it goes back to the persona idea that I don't think that there is a one size fits all rule of thumb for teachers to I would recoil that anyone would read one textbook on education or observe one truly great teacher and then try to do that. Everything has to be in a context. And so I end the book by talking about the complexity of teaching, because it really is an endlessly complex, and that can be frustrating, endlessly complex task. And the understanding that there's no one answer to any problem, and I talk about it in the context of cheating, is an important understanding. We have to realize that context matters, and that there's no sort of one definition of good teaching. It's more a recognition of how to figure out what solutions in a particular context would work. And again, that involves adopting some sort of persona that would be able to come to that answer easily. But it does mean that teaching is complex. And so there's a chapter on why you should ignore cheating, which I don't literally mean, but I do mean that in thinking about it, cheating, we need to think about the entire learning environment that we create and think about the role in which our anti-cheating policies may fit into that and may obstruct a lot of the learning we want to go on. So that's just one example that there's a lot of balls in the air here. We're going to drop a lot, but we're going to try to keep a lot up in the air as we go. But slavery to one particular understanding of what education is going to lead to them all falling on the ground, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see that cheating chapter, that was the part of the reading that I wasn't going to explain to the listeners. I'm trying to take your lesson seriously here.
We can just leave it at that. There's a chapter in the book on why you should ignore cheating, and if that doesn't get people wanting to read the book, I don't know what will.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Lindsay, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add one thing that when we were talking about personas and that I had mentioned in that chapter was that we, and think about the context of the classroom, one thing I think really bears emphasizing is that we're not the only teachers in the room. You know, all the students are teachers too. Mm-hmm. And we've put them all in a room. And one of the reasons to avoid things like showing them a movie is that that doesn't really tap into this, you know, as you say, inner subjective or at least social environment that we've created. And so there are a lot of teaching personas in the room. There, you know, you can get students to, if you will, teach in ways that you perhaps can't, because perhaps you know the material so well you don't understand the cognitive difficulties that students have. They do understand them. And if you can tap into that, you've created an environment, a classroom that has its own persona. And I think that's really the takeaway of that persona. You should stop, as professors, thinking about that it's our persona that matters so much as it's the character of the environment that we create, and that involves more than just us.
Very good. Well, I have been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I want you to have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about teaching, learning, craft approaches, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Only that, to go back to where we began, that teaching as a craft is something. And now you've made me think about Aristotle, so I'm glad you've done. I mentioned Plato more often than I mentioned Aristotle, but you've had me thinking of Aristotle here. That teaching is something as a craft that ought to go to the heart of who you are, give you fulfillment and enjoyment when it's done well. And those two things go hand in hand. You know, if you're not doing it well, you're not going to enjoy it, and if you're not enjoying it, you probably aren't doing it well. So it's something to get excited about and not to avoid. And I think anyone who's spent their life in academia should understand that and
I hope the book is one small way of getting people to remind themselves of that.
Peter Lindsay, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed talking with you and talking about the book and about education.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and for listening in with us. The book is The Craft of University Teaching from University of Toronto Press. You can find a link to it on the show notes. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.